You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Yesterday, the Egyptian popular movements finally forced the collapse of the regime of hated dictator Hosni Mubarak. On that same day, 32 years ago, the regime of the Shah of Iran collapsed during the Iranian Revolution. That revolution ushered in the era of the Islamic Republic of Iran. While that era has marked a period of independence from foreign domination, inside Iran, the repressive regime of the Shah was replaced by another highly repressive regime, that of the clerics and mullahs. In recent years, that regime too has seen popular uprisings against it. As events unfold in Egypt and other parts of the Middle East, comparisons are inevitably being made. To discuss some of this, I am now joined by Saeed Ranema. Saeed is a professor of political science at York University and comments regularly on Iran and the Middle East. He joins me on the phone now from Toronto. Good morning, Saeed, and welcome to Red Eye.
Good morning, Manuel. Thank you.
As things progress in Egypt, comparisons are starting to be made between what's happening there and the Iranian Revolution. In particular, commentators are frequently mentioning the potential for another Islamic State. How comparable do you think this Egyptian revolution is to the Iranian Revolution 32 years ago?
Well, I mean, there are so many different dimensions to it. There are many similarities and, of course, differences. The similarities was that in both cases, there were a dictator. There was a dictator for almost three decades, ruling with iron fist and backed by Americans and CIA. And they followed, on the one hand, on the economic policy, the neoliberal policy, following the type of advices by World Bank, IMF, and multinational corporations in both cases. And they continued up until there was an upheaval as a result of this crisis in Iran and, of course, in Egypt for other reasons, which was had its own background inside Egypt and also triggered by the situation in Tunisia. So there are these similarities, but also there are similarities. I mean, one of it, the irony for dictator was that both of them, of course, as you rightly said, happens on the same day, 11th of February. And in both cases, in a sense, the role of military is very significant, The difference is that in Iran, military in the last day of revolution, they announced neutrality, so quote-unquote neutrality. And that was when Heuser, General Heuser, who was UN second in command, came to Iran and assessed the situation and thought that Shah has no chances. Shah had already left and told the generals that, okay, you go and pledge your allegiance to Khomeini. This is the phone number. So they did, except two of them who were killed in the afternoon. The rest were executed by the regime. So it's a very different story. In Egypt, the army actually on the first day of the revolt, they expressed their neutrality. And that was exactly because of the lessons that they learned from Iran, Americans, Israelis, army itself. They wanted to make sure that army would remain as a major player regardless of what will happen. So Americans were assessing that if they end up losing their dictator, at least they would maintain the status quo, maintain the social system. And that was our anticipation from day one. When this happened, we said, okay, there will be two players in any case, regardless of what happens. One would be army, and the other one would be the Muslim Brotherhood. You rightly made a comparison between the two, because in both cases, in the absence of democracy and suppression of secular forces, left forces, liberal and nationalist forces, only organizations that could be active were mosques and were religious organizations. That's why under these dictatorships, these two religious organizations remained and they grew and became very significant. In Iran, of course, they usurped the whole revolution. Khomeini even fooled the left in Iran by promising that he would respect democracy and none of the clerics would intervene in politics. But we know what happened later. But in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood played a different role. Muslim Brotherhood during the revolt in the past 18 years or 18 days or so, sort of played very low key, you know, pretending that they do not want to be involved in government and other things. My anticipation is that no doubt, whatever happens, they will be stronger, much stronger, but not to the extent that they would be able to form a religious state like Iran. Why? Partly because of the experience of Iran itself. The army will not allow it. Americans who are backing the army will not allow it. And definitely there is another aspect that, proximity to Israel. I mean, the mere fact that the whole West and America were in panic was exactly what's going to happen with Israelis. You know, if there is really a revolution that would continue and then with higher demands. That's why they moved toward controlling it, and so far they have been successful.
Iran itself has seen massive uprisings in the last years. How comparable are they to the Egyptian uprisings?
Excellent question. You know, while in terms of spontaneity and in terms of spontaneous reaction of the people, you can compare the 2009 revolt and the 2011 Egyptian revolt. But they are very different, you know, in terms of the type of achievement that they may have. Aspirations are the same, you know. Aspiration was that they want to get rid of an authoritarian regime, but the situation is very different. In Iran, as in your introduction, you rightly mentioned, Iran is not dependent on any foreign power. So its army does not take orders from Americans or CIA or this and that. But at the same time, they are not reliant on a single man. In Iran, you have got a type of religious military oligarchy, which is based on some sort of semi-fascist style of governance. Why? Because there are intricate web of different institutions, different foundations, that not only you have got double-decker bureaucracy and army security services, but also you have got these religious, very rich religious foundations called Bunyad, who have millions of people on their payroll, who can mobilize them in the ballot boxes and also bring them into streets as thugs to attack genuine demonstrations. So the difference is that in Egypt, they could target Mubarak, and in a sense, they succeed in getting rid of one dictator. What replaces it, that's a different story that if we have time, we'll discuss it. But in Iran, the Iranian people have a much more difficult task ahead of them to confront this semi-fascist regime, which has gotten still some support, despite the fact that the majority of Iranian people hate this regime, are fed up with this regime, and they want to get rid of Islamists with all the corruptions and all the cultural, political degradation that Iran has been suffering.
One of the things that's not talked about very much in, say, the case of the protests in Iran or those in Egypt is how women are sort of involved, highly involved in these movements. What roles are women playing in these reform movements?
No doubt, in both cases, women were very active. But comparatively speaking, no doubt the role of Iranian women have been much, much wider and stronger. both in 1979 revolution and also in 2009 revolt against Ahmadinejad. In 1979, women of Iran were among the first group that almost in second or third week of the new regime under Khomeini and Islamists, they started a mass demonstrations against order of Khomeini, who wanted to force women to wear veil and also go back home. They wanted to, his belief was that women are to be mothers and wives, you know, not as engineers or lawyers and other things. And they revolted against this, despite the fact that, of course, no organization, including left organization, supported them. In 2009, the Iranian women actually were leading the revolution. Before the election, they came up with something that they called demand-based campaign, and they said that we are not going to support any candidate, but we have got these demands, which is the protection of women's rights, and we don't have time to go into the details, and any candidate which recognized this, we would support it. And of course, as we know, they were all suppressed. The extent of involvement of women, while you see more in Iran, less in Tunisia, and the least in Egypt. This is how I can see it.
Now, Iranian President Ahmadinejad has praised the Egyptian protesters and compared the protests there favorably to the Iranian Revolution, but he's quashed similar movements in his own country. How do you see that contradiction playing out?
Ahmadinejad is a hypocrite, you know. I mean, it's very obvious that not only him and also Khamenei, both of them say that this is an Islamic revolution, which is absolutely nonsense, you know. First of all, there are no Islamic slogans, and the vast majority of people are secular, and vast majority of people are afraid of Islamists, and they don't want the repeat of Iran. And actually, the reason why they say it, they are very much scared, you know. The Iranian regime is terribly scared. That's why they did not even allow peaceful demonstration that they had requested, people had requested, you know, for the anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, 22th of Bahman or 11th of February. They did not allow it because they are afraid that this would rekindle again the flames of protest. And it will, you know. I mean, while they succeeded, you know, using brutal repression, using thugs, using, killings and executions, while they have silenced so far the movement, part of it is Green Movement, but Green Movement is a part of a larger movement in the Iranian civil society, which is you've got secular and you've got moderate religious and men and women and intellectuals and all, workers and all layers of society. But they will not be able, and they were not able to kill these civil society. And that's why they are very afraid of it. They came with congratulations, but I'm sure they are very scared of the prospect. And this is what will happen. We don't know when. But as I said, Iranians have a more difficult job, but definitely they will get rid of this regime.
And how do you think popular movements here in Canada can best support these various movements in the Middle East?
I think this is very significant, you know, that the public would realize that, first of all, we cannot call these just exactly revolutions, you know, if you get rid of a dictator, but you have a military junta taking over the whole situation. This is very unfortunate, you know. The Canadian public, particularly the more enlightened one, progressive one, can support and demand that really the revolution or protest would not stop at this stage and would continue, because if it does not continue, Egyptians will not get what they wanted. There is no doubt, of course, no doubt that regime will not go back to what it was. You know, they cannot have another dictator coming at least for the foreseeable future. But the main issue is that there is quite possibility that if they do not push, they will not be part of any bargaining. And ironically, you know, at this stage, even since pressure was not that high, if it's considered three layers of politics going on in Egypt, one at the regime, an ancien regime and the military, the second one, traditional political parties, which there are lots of political parties, you know, left, nationalist, socialist, and religious. But and then there is the people and leadership in the street, in Tahrir Square and other places, Alexandria. The interesting thing is that when they formed the junta, even they did not bring people from the second layer. The conservative traditional parties, let alone revolutionaries in the street. So there is a chance that they really silence this revolution and they try to fool people. I think this is an area that Canadians and the West can support the democratic movement to prevent another dictatorship. And also, there is the question of Israeli-Palestinian issue that we didn't have time to discuss, you know. I mean, this is another lesson for Israel, that Israel so far was reliant on dictators, along with Americans, on neighboring countries, say, for example, in Jordan and in Egypt, signing treaties, signing peace treaties with them, and not paying attention to the resolution of resolving the problem of Palestinians. Now they should know that so far as Palestinian case is not resolved, then there will be lots and lots of problems. And we should hope that at least this will have another positive aspect in terms of peace with Israel and Palestinian, and we move toward a better period. I hope so, but I'm very pessimistic at this stage. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks very much for joining us this
morning.
Thank
you, Manuel.
It's been very interesting. I've been speaking with Saeed Ranima. He is a professor of political science at York University, and he comments regularly on Iran and the Middle East.